Ride Report, a podcast from the Master Executive Council of JetBlue Alpha for the union pilots of JetBlue. Now from New York, Ride Report.
Well, hello once again, and welcome back, fellow JetBlue Alpha pilots, to Ride Report. I'm your host, J.R. Hall from JetBlue Alpha Central Air Safety. Look, it is no doubt been way too long since our last episode, but between holiday peak flying and everything that was wrapped up into our most recent contract extension, we did get a chance to update some of the equipment, polish up the calendar, and work on some upcoming episodes for Ride Report this year and so on. So we do look extremely forward to getting Ride Report back to the regular cadence of bringing you a little extra insight to the ongoing work of our union, the committees, and hear from the volunteers who dedicate themselves to serve our pilot group. I just spoke to the time between now and our last episode, and in one facet of our industry, it has just been increasingly focused, and recently, the topic of a FAA summit, aviation safety. We as professional pilots, we're all well aware of the recent runway incursions, for example, at an industry level. And we're also going to discuss that in great detail with our guest today, but we also want to bring it right back to our company, JetBlue and JetBlue Alpha, and discuss some of the ongoing work within our aviation safety, central air safety, discuss everything from air quality events, fatigue, and to get us all started on that, we'd like to welcome back to Ride Report JetBlue Alpha Central Air Safety Chair and Captain Blake Kelly. Blake, how are you?
Good, JR. Good to be back.
I tell you what, we've got a whole lot of stuff to get into, but first, I just real quick want to say congratulations on your recent upgrade.
Thank you, JR. It's good to finally take the plunge and take the upgrade and learning a lot.
And just for the gouge, how long between training and OE?
Hopefully, it will be shorter for those that are awaiting upgrade. For me, it was a very long time. I think a total process from in a training till Fed ride was 8 weeks for me.
As internet poster would say, your mileage may vary, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Hopefully those OE times have come down significantly.
Blake, we got a lot of stuff to jump into. We just talked about the FAA Safety Summit and just from a high-level industry, but we're going to highlight a couple things that we're going to go a little bit more in-depth on, just the state of JetBlue and what our safety programs are up to. Central air safety updates. There's been a lot of chatter about fatigue, specifically in pairing construction for not only upcoming months, but possibly future months, odor fumes, and then a couple other hot topic items. But give us a little bit of the insight on the recent FAA summit.
Well, thanks, JR. And it's very timely to have this episode and talk about safety. I'm sure our pilot group has noticed in the media a lot of chatter about recent safety events. Several notable runway incursions. We know about the event in New York with Delta and American, when American taxied on a runway when Delta was departing and had to reject takeoff. We know about the event in Austin where a Southwest plane was taking off right when a FedEx plane was landing. So there's certainly a lot of attention on these events. There's also been events that are not as highly publicized but are significant. Lithium battery fires. We had one at JetBlue. And turbulence events, turbulence injury events. So there's a lot going on, a lot of chatter. So the FAA acting administrator, Billy Nolen, set up a call to action meeting with industry leaders on March 15th. That's available online to see the public portion of that forum, if any pilot's interested. But a lot of discussion about this spike in safety events and trying to get our arms around what is going on in the industry. And there was a lot of good dialogue from a lot of industry leaders, from the FAA, from the airlines, from our own ALPA president, Jason Ambrosi, was there and spoke, the NTSB, airports management. You know, I mean, the good thing is the industry is recognizing this and responding. I mean, we're not waiting for accidents. You know, we're using incidents and making sure our safety data at all the various airlines and industry are being actioned to address these safety concerns.
I don't want to take it back to COVID, but this is still kind of airlines increasing their operation because the public is willing to come out more and more so and more often to travel. And then we bring in holiday peak travel, a huge ramp up in operations, a huge ramp up in frequency, and creates these opportunities.
No, yeah, very, very much so, JR. I mean, there's no smoking gun of where the spike in industry, a spike in events are coming from, but there was a lot of discussion about exactly what you're bringing up is, we've had a major transformation of the industry from the spool down to COVID, then the spool up. There's been a drastic change in the experience levels of, you know, again, pilots. There's been a lot of pilot hiring, and the experience level of pilots now coming into airlines has reduced. We'll talk a lot about that, how it affects JetBlue, and that experience level dropping in all work groups in the industry. The staffing challenges, you know, staffing challenges not only at the airlines, but at the FAA with air traffic controllers, that was discussed. Infrastructure, you know, we lost the NOTAM system, you know, if you recall, and that was a an impact to the operation in the industry. And so there's a lot of infrastructure issues. So there's a lot of talk about that. And this is all also on the backdrop of with the FAA reauthorization bill being up for discussion. So there's a lot of, you know, public attention on this and a lot of public discussion of what investments need to be made at the FAA. All these factors were discussed and debated at that FAA summit and are continuing.
When it comes to the topic of lithium ion batteries and events that take place in the cabin, I kind of want to, I don't know how in depth we can go, but to give the general listener kind of an idea why this is a deal. There are sometimes luggage that has a bag. It's super convenient, right? You can plug your phone right in and charge your phone from your suitcase. Well, it's got to come from a battery pack, and that battery pack's got to be recharged. And a lot of these recent advancements in batteries do present, for lack of a better word, an opportunity for something to go wrong and either overcharge that battery or overheat that battery. And when you put that in the confines of an airplane, that's where it becomes a real significant risk. And you hear at the gate all the time, before you get on the airplane, make sure that, you know, no lithium ion batteries are out or the batteries are disconnected. It's for that big reason alone, to prevent the risk, to mitigate the risk of having any kind of battery-related event in the cabin of an airplane, whether you're on the ground or whether you're 6 miles high in the sky. What were some of the items that were discussed surrounding that?
Yeah, so I at the public portion of the FAA safety summit, I don't think lithium battery fires were discussed in any detail. The FAA summit did have a private portion that was breakout session of industry leaders that were behind closed doors. But lithium batteries have been a known risk for some time, and there's a lot of industry work around mitigating that issue that you discussed, JR. There's obviously a lot of work trying to be done to prevent, you know, batteries that could be hazardous onto airplanes and within the cabin, right? So certification standards with how those batteries are built and transported. There's also, you know, working and making sure that damaged, you know, batteries also are, you know, prevented to get on airplanes, and trying to educate the public. You know, lithium batteries are now in almost everything we have.
Sure.
And misuse, mischarging, overcharging, damage, you know, trying to educate the public on the hazard of that battery being in the cabin. So there's a lot of work being done there. But the part that at our airline is trying to say, okay, if this battery gets on and does ignite and have a thermal runaway event, how are we going to, you know, identify that and fight that fire, whether the aircraft's on the ground, taxiing at the gate, or in the air, and having procedures and tools in place to make sure we can adequately fight and contain that fire till we can, you know, get on the ground or get it dealt with.
The other thing you spoke to, and I know this is just not a JetBlue problem. It is an industry problem, and every other operator sees this as well. As the number of flights increase, the frequency of airplanes taking off and landing at airports across the country every day requires two well-qualified, highly trained pilots. And there has been a rapid growth in onboarding of these professional pilots and the time that it takes to get them trained. There was discussion about hiring experience, required staffing levels, and then the infrastructure to support all that as well. And they highlighted that, but to bring it to a little bit closer of a level to us, here at JetBlue, we're seeing some of the same issues as well. What were some of the things discussed in that realm as far as experience and hiring?
You know, experience levels have dropped in all the various work groups in our industry, but specifically to pilots. You know, that's obviously, you know, we are hiring at all the major airlines close to ATP minimums. And so there was a lot of discussion about how do we enhance training to meet this new experience level. ALPA's position, and was made clear, is that, you know, we don't want to see any reduction in the experience requirements that we've established and have seen a good safety record. This isn't the time to reduce risk controls. It's actually to enhance risk controls and improve training and other things.
I want to bring it back to JetBlue and specifically the work that Central Air Safety is doing among the various subcommittees. We're talking pairings and fatigue. We touched a little bit on new hire and first officer experience levels, but there are also many new recent captain upgrades and for sometimes first time captains in their aviation experience. Merger talks, distractions, that's obviously something that's going on that's bending everybody's ear locally here at JetBlue and Spirit Airlines. And then cabin odor and fume events. Where, out of all this list, where do we begin?
I don't know, JR. I think just talking about our pilot group, I mean, we've come out of COVID, a huge ramp up, Section 6 negotiations, you know, the prospect of a acquisition and merger with Spirit, transitioning to a short-term CBA extension. It's all this that could be distracting our pilot group, and, you know, bringing the focus to when we are, you know, on the flight deck is focusing on that flight and minimize those distractions and those conversations, because it's just been noise and backdrop that could easily pull us to distract us at a time when we're doing our duty. So, but then I migrate to, I think, the hot topic, and we talked about with the FAA summit, and is the experience levels of hiring. There's a lot of chatter about attrition and the experience and attracting experienced pilots to come here for a career, and all the airlines are dealing with that. You know, Delta, United, they're hiring pilots with ATP minimums, you know, 1500 hours, where the competitive hours were much higher several years ago before COVID. I mean, when I was hired here, competitive hours were 4,000 hours, and you usually had extensive time at a regional, and you had time as a regional captain. Mm-hmm. That's not the case. Right now, we're seeing pilots being hired now that maybe a very short stint at a regional, never upgraded at a regional, and they're coming to JetBlue and going through our training program. We're in a lot of discussions with the company about where we can enhance training to meet, you know, this new experience level coming in. We have not changed our training footprint or lengthened it since AQP here at JetBlue. So that's something that's being discussed. Our OE, the amount of OE we allocate to pilots hasn't changed. So, but we're certainly seeing the experience level change, and we're seeing that how that's going through our training program and how that's going through our OE program, and then how it's going to operating on the line. And with the experience level of our new hires, we're also, you know, like you said, we have a lot of upgrades, new upgrade captains. And like me, this is my first upgrade at an airline. Not only am I a brand new captain, first time captain, I'm flying with pilots that have been here at JetBlue for less than a year and had very little experience at the regionals. So this is something we do have to acknowledge. We're certainly trying to work with the company and with our safety programs to see where we can enhance, you know, training and procedures and other things to help support our pilots now that are facing this. But it's certainly something we need help from the pilot group to help inform our safety programs. We'll talk more about how we can do that through our safety reporting programs and ensuring we highlight these issues and when we're meeting the need.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to discuss the recent, it feels like, you know, we say 2 years ago and it's like, my God, that was forever ago. But we do have now specific to the safety LOA and the process and the work that went into that as a crosstalk agreement in principle. So we'll definitely dive into that and what it means and the importance of safety reporting. But most recently, there was a communication from our system scheduling committee, which they put out on regular cadence just before the pairings are open as to how they were built. Was it the association? Was it the company? Was it a combination of the both?
Sure, JR. This is definitely a hot topic when I'm out on the line. Pilots want to talk about the pairings and a lot of chat around them. I think I do want to give some background. I'm trying not to get too far out of my lane. I'm not, you know, again, I'm the safety committee, not scheduling, but we work very closely with our scheduling committee volunteers on addressing fatigue. But to explain a little bit of the process, everyone's pretty familiar with the fact that we have ALPA volunteers building pairings in parallel with the company and try to compete on, you know, building a pairing set that addresses a lot of the things we would want to see as pilots, right? Quality of life, productivity, operability, and addressing fatigue. At the end of the day, the company will pick a pairing set, and the most competitive part of deciding which pairing set to go with is cost, right? So our ALPA scheduling committee folks are, you know, they're pretty limited on enhancements they can make to the pairing set without getting their cost parameters being outside of what the company builds. And so that's very much a limiting factor. But when it comes to fatigue, you know, up until recently, you know, our pilots that are building the pairings, obviously they know what could be fatiguing when they're building pairings. However, really our fatigue program does not influence pairing construction. So to try to explain that a little bit more is we do not have fatigue data and fatigue subject matter expertise involved in pairing construction, both on the ALPA or company side. And the only proactive measures we've had is the CBA requirement running the pairings through a program called Safety Fast. I don't know if a lot of our pilots are familiar with what that is, but Safety Fast is a biomathematical model of predicting effectiveness through a pairing and fatigue levels. So we have an agreed upon level that the pairing you need to be above throughout the whole pairing for that pairing to be published. There's a provision that allows us to publish pairings below that level. We've never done that since the CBA. So all these pairings have to be over that software level of fatigue risk. The challenge is that it's a model. Okay, models, the famous phrase is, all models are wrong, some are useful. So it's a model that assumes a lot of things. It assumes how the average pilot would sleep, how much sleep they would get. Again, the pairing, it's based on the pairing flown as scheduled. There are just averages of transportation times and other things in there. So there's a lot of variability of actually how this pairing is going to be flown and what the pilot's going to experience. And there's a lot of variability between different pilots. You know, JR, you might nap, your napping strategy for a red eye probably different than mine, and it might be different than what the model is predicting. But at least what Safety Fast does for us is prevent a lot of fatigue factors from being published in a pairing set. It's a good way of cutting out and establishing a minimum level of fatigue protection. But what we want to do is get more fatigue data from our fatigue reports, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and subject matter experts on fatigue, you know, experts on fatigue that we have on our fatigue volunteers on the fatigue subcommittee of the Central Air Safety Committee, and then the fatigue experts of the company working with those that are building the pairings to help increase the quality in addressing fatigue. And so in that last communication, we're working with the company now on improving that process and that closed loop. What we're looking for is, again, for the pilots to continue to feed data to us that can then be fed into the pairing construction process.
Right, because please don't think, you know, as a pilot, that my voice is somehow ineffective. The way that safety fast works is on a basic human level, a good way to put it. But we can definitely, as pilots, affect a change by interjecting our subjective experience into whatever it was we were assigned to fly. It is vitally important to share that experience, especially in the fatigue hazard report.
Yes, and fatigue reporting is certainly been up. Our rolling 12-month average has only been increasing. We've had definitely a high number of fatigue reports, but the majority portion, in fact, nearly all of our fatigue reports are what are called fatigue removal events, or FREs. That's when you call out fatigue, and under most situations, you are required to file a fatigue report. And that's a majority of the data we've been getting. However, like you mentioned, fatigue hazard reports, we also track those, and those are extremely useful. And that's when you did not call out fatigue, but you either operated a pairing that or a flight that, wow, you know, if anything had gone wrong on this flight, or there was things here that could have generated fatigue, or you were in fact fatigued. You flew it and you go, you know what? I now, in hindsight, can see how fatigued I was. You know, a lot of what I hear from a lot of pilots is, I'm afraid to say that. I'm afraid I'm basically saying I violated my fitness for duty by putting that in a report.
Sure.
That's not the case.
Yeah.
You know, we understand, you know, it's very hard to assess. One of the hardest things as pilots is to assess our fatigue level and know that we are good to operate that flight. And you know, that assessment is difficult. And then once we take the plane airborne, it's not like we can pull over and take a nap. That is totally understood in our program. So it's absolutely, though, critical data, and some of the most valuable data we can use to action are from fatigue hazard reports. An example, taking it back to pairing construction, right? Our typical fatigue callouts, are because of operational delays or other workload issues. You know, underneath all these issues that made you, you know, all these factors that contributed to fatigue, contributed to call out, you know, the pairing and the construction of that pairing could have been a factor, but it's buried underneath all the delays and other operational issues. That data for the pairing gets lost, you know, that was a factor that needs to be looked at. That fatigue hazard report allows us to completely focus on that one factor, which is how that pairing was scheduled.
Blake, real quick, specific to fatigue, remind us the difference between when it comes to fatigue reporting and coding, system versus non-system. Some are very familiar with it, some may not be familiar with it, but what does that mean to the pilot and to the program?
Sure, JR. You know, I think one of the big questions we get on the fatigue program, when pilots are considering calling out fatigue, you know, there's a lot of factors are concerned about, a lot of pressures of how it's going to affect their fellow crew members, how it's going to affect their schedule. Is there any possibility of discipline or anything? And then also, you know, am I going to get paid, or am I going to have to use PTO? And so the first thing is absolutely you're protected if you call fatigue for any reason at any time. So if you are not fit for duty, you have a professional responsibility to call out fatigue. But the factor is, when we look at every fatigue call out event, there's a team called the Fatigue Risk Management Team, or FRMT, that is a representative from the company's fatigue program and an ALPA fatigue subcommittee representative that will review the reports and decide if the causal factor, the primary factor of that fatigue call out, was it something that was in control of the company, or was it something that was in control on the individual pilot? So examples of system driven are, you know, delays, operational factors, hotel, you know, rest issues at the hotel. Non-system driven are things that are, you know, getting rest at home, commuting issues affecting rest. Those would be factors that would be non-system. And so this team reviews it, decides if it's determined to be system driven, that will be pay protected by the company. If it's non-system driven, the pay will come out of the pilot's PTO. right now we run about 90 to 93% of all fatigue callouts are determined to be system driven. So a large majority of our fatigue calls are pay protected. But it's important that pilots don't make that determination of calling fatigue, you know, am I going to get paid or not? We have a professional responsibility to declare fatigue if we're unfit to operate. And so even if it's a non-system, determined to be a non-system fatigue call, that is still a good fatigue call to make. The only factor is using your PTO, but that's still important to not fly fatigued.
And from a JetBlue pilot perspective, that fatigue hazard report can also be found on our EFBs under the GEMS app, correct?
Yes. So you go on the GEMS app on our iPads, company issued iPads, and there's a fatigue report, and it's just a selection in the report itself when you're filling it out. Is this a fatigue removal event, or are you reporting a fatigue hazard? So it's in the same report. It's just a toggle switch you're going to pick when you file that report.
Let's shift gears, if you're ready, to air quality events and some of the work that Environmental Standards has been doing specifically to cabin odor events and cabin fume events as well. Overview of the issue, just to kind of remind everybody exactly what it is that we're looking for and some of the work that's been done just recently.
Sure. This has been a frustrating issue that we've been working for a very long time. We use the term odor, fumes, cabin air quality. These are all synonymous, but it's when you smell something in the flight deck or in the cabin or on the flight deck, and you're trying to determine, well, what is that? And the most notable issue is, sure, there's a lot of things that could smell. You could have exhaust outside the airplane that is coming in through the system or something that just smells bad in the airplane somewhere. But the most notable issue that we've been focused on is oil contamination into the environmental control system. When that happens, it definitely creates a very distinct smell that is certainly coming from the environmental control system. It's been described as dirty socks. It can also be kind of a humid smell or musty smell. It could be like a magic marker smell, but that is a clear indicator that oil has gotten into the environmental control system. And honestly, it has to be under the right conditions, both from a moisture content of the atmosphere and temperature, to create that smell. And without that smell, you know, oil could be there and you might not have any odor. That is the issue, and that's what we're very focused on, because oil should not be in the environmental control system. There's a lot of factors, which we'll talk about how it gets in there. But if we have that distinct odor or fume, we need to write it up, because oil should not be in that environmental control system, and it needs to be dealt with.
And it's important to generate that logbook action so the company can go in and take action, correct?
Correct, because some of the factors that are most notable right now of how that oil gets there, it could be from a over-servicing event, right? Over-servicing oil in the engines or in the APU. But right now the leading cause is issues with our APUs and sources of leaks from the APU that can leak oil into the system. So there's a compressor fan seal issue. There's oil cooler fan issues. Writing it up is important, because oil is leaking from somewhere or it was over service. So we need to identify, where is the oil coming from? That's a technical issue that needs to be fixed. And then the system is contaminated. It's got oil in the system where it doesn't belong, and that oil needs to be removed. And really the only way is to do a decontamination of the environmental control system, which is pretty involved.
And that brings in the pilot participation in some of those corrective actions that the company is trying to resolve this problem, decontaminations or engine runs, right?
Yes. Yeah, so the most important thing is to write it up. You know, a lot of times you might get a whiff of something, it's transient, and you think, oh, you know, it's not a big deal. It didn't affect anybody. No one else is complaining about it, but you let it go. And unfortunately, that is the plane trying to tell you something's wrong with it, and you're passing it to now another crew that might have a significant acute odor fume event that could affect crews and customers. So it's important to write it up. And when you do write it up, it's important to be detailed and follow the FOM guidance so you can give a clear identification to maintenance of what the problem is. Vague or incomplete write-ups, unfortunately, maintenance might identify they think it's something else, like a cabin-induced, like, you know, something smell bad, and they think, oh, maybe a customer threw up or talked about throwing up, and they go, okay, well, we'll just write it off as that. And unfortunately, that leads maintenance down the wrong path and not addressing the issue. So it's important that if you identify that it's coming from the environmental control system, and if you can isolate it to the forward or the aft, you know, maybe to isolate which pack, if it was coming from when you use the APU bleed, you know, identifying that. And there's an odor survey form in the law book. It's an Airbus form that collects even more information than you write in the defect box, capturing all of that. So you clearly outline the issue to maintenance, and they will follow their set of procedures to fully address the issue.
If I'm a pilot that is being asked to, on top of all the reporting, I've given a very comprehensive report. I'm doing my very best to try and put all the information in there. And at the end of the day, I'm a pilot who is next to a mechanic trying to work this problem. Who do I reach out to if I have a concern? Because obviously we all want to make the best possible decision, and we're weighing both sides. But if a pilot feels comfortable to do it, is that okay? And in the same vein, if a pilot does not feel comfortable, they don't want any additional exposure or risk, or they just need a timeout, is that okay as well?
Sure, JR. I think there's two issues you're pointing to. One is, you know, if in the troubleshooting process, maintenance requests help, they may ask you to do an engine run, which, is outlined how to do that and what the requirements are in the FOM. If you know, they need, unfortunately, in a lot of our outstations, the technicians for the business partners there, contract maintenance, they're not engine run qualified. So they may ask the pilot, hey, we need your help to run the engines to help diagnose if this is environmental control system odor or fume. And you know, you can do that if you want to, but you are not required to or expected to. That is above and beyond your job as a pilot here at JetBlue. So, you know, a lot of questions we get are, well, I don't want to do that. I'm concerned about my safety and the safety of my crew members. I don't want to participate. Can you refuse to do it? Absolutely. That is not an aircraft refusal. You're being asked to help, and you don't have to help. If you do, though, there's precautions you certainly might want to consider. If you want to discuss with somebody and utilize all your resources, if you're going to participate in engine run, certainly using the duty pilot in the SOC, the chief pilot, obviously calling the ALPA hotline, that would get someone from my team that you could talk to, you know, one of our experts in the Environmental Standards Committee or myself, and walk through your concerns and how, if you're going to do this, how to protect yourself. You know, obviously some of our major recommendations is to, you know, be on oxygen when you do the engine run, and then also, you know, making sure you follow the FOM guidelines and the limitations there. You can't do an engine run above idle, you know, breakaway thrust is the limit. And we've had a few instances where even technicians want pilots' help to do what's called a pack burn, or that environmental control system decontamination. That is purely a maintenance procedure. There's certainly a lot of risk there when you are actually burning out the environmental ducts with high heat. That's kind of what you're doing. And again, that you need to check if you can really do that, because sometimes that requires an engine thrust above breakaway thrust, which is requires a technical pilot or a maintenance technician to do that's qualified. To go a little further with your question, JR, you know, again, what if maintenance does what they think is enough to address the issue and you're still concerned that the issue has not been rectified? That's when you need to consider, you know, if you feel necessary to refuse the airplane. And if you do so, you know, making that, you know, you certainly want to go through all the resources in the SOC, speaking with dispatch, maintenance control, the duty pilot, even a chief pilot, to make sure you've made your concerns clear and give the company a chance to address them. And if they can't, refuse the airplane, fill out your FCIR and your ASAP and cite the safety concerns.
Take us through real quick, following some kind of an air quality event. A pilot notes that in the aircraft maintenance logbook and then closes, makes the telephone call. What plays out after that to the maintenance corrective action?
This is something that we've been watching and working a lot with maintenance on. We have a monthly meeting with the director of maintenance and the chief inspector or director of quality here at JetBlue, as well as with our director of operations. And that meeting includes myself and our environmental standards committee chairman, Captain Nick Hoffman. And we certainly have been working with maintenance to ensure they're following the appropriate corrective actions for when you write up an odor or fume event that definitely is attributed to the environmental control system. And we don't want to get too much in how maintenance should be performed, but what you can expect is if it's determined that it's the environmental control system, that the engines and APU have to be inspected. And then if there's a suspect components, they need to be MEL'd or deactivated. Most notably, we see is a lot of the APU bleed or the APU itself will be MEL'd. But then the system has to be decontaminated. So the environmental control system has to be decontaminated, and there's three different levels of procedure for that. And that may be difficult or impossible in an outstation. So if that environmental control system cannot be decontaminated, the option may have to be to MEL the entire environmental control system, which means both packs have to be MEL'd as well. And that plane will have to be ferried to a place where unpressurized, where that maintenance can be performed. So, but it's important though that maintenance gets on the right track and they identify that what the odor and fume is. So that's why the appropriate write-up is important, but then they need to follow those procedures.
Very good. And in the last couple of minutes here, Blake, I do want to talk about just the importance of, if you do have some type of air quality event, the importance of writing it up and notifying the company, because it does a couple, two, three things where, we have within Central Air Safety a pilot outreach program for significant events, of which an air quality event qualifies. When we get a notification from the company, a member of Central Air Safety is reaching out to the flight crew to offer, number one, immediate assistance if you need, and general reminders for the required reporting and the suggested reporting when it comes from that. And it's, once again, an immediate quick link that if a pilot does run into any kind of an issue, you know who to call or who to get in touch with quick for quick assistance. But all of that backs up to the first pilot action of reporting something that they smell.
Absolutely. The logbook write-up is the most critical thing to do, but we do reach out, as you said, and there is other mandatory reporting required following an odor fume event that you have to follow in the FOM. And then we are also advocating for ASAP reports to make sure we collect the safety data, and it helps us track and trend this issue.
And just before we get into the reporting and engagement of the pilot group in those reports, I did mention it just a little bit ago, but the Crosstalk AIP as the completion of everything that we set out to accomplish within the safety LOA is a recent agreement in principle with the company. Give us a quick update on that, and then we'll talk about the importance of reporting and pilot engagement.
Sure, JR. So we did put out some communication to the pilot group following LOA 16 and during LOA 16 discussions. The company was very interested on implementing a crosstalk program. And what is crosstalk? Crosstalk is kind of an industry term to talk about how you may integrate the ASAP and FOCO programs more and allow data to be shared across those two programs. At the time, we were more focused on establishing an LOA to fortify our ASAP and FOCO programs and other safety programs independently. And we didn't think as an association, we were ready to entertain crosstalk, but we reached an agreement in MOU 18 that after we got LOA 16, we would discuss if we were to implement crosstalk, what would it need to have and what would it look like? There's a lot of safety benefits to sharing safety data across programs. However, you know, there's confidentiality concerns and concerns about how that data can be used and any misuse of that data. The most notable concern is, you know, if you submit an ASAP, the ability for the pilot event review committee, again, that's the one member from the FAA, one from the company, and a representative from ALPA that review that ASAP report and investigate it, they could request to look at the FOQA data of that flight to help them understand what occurred and provide better feedback and recommendations. One thing we don't want is for FOQA data to suddenly be used as a means to accuse the pilot of not being accurate or misleading or falsification. And we also don't want the data to be used for any other thing for, you know, a reason to exclude an ASAP report. That's not the purpose of the program. And so we've talked through all those different mechanisms of how to integrate these programs in a way that benefit the company, benefit our pilot group, and are entirely meant for safety and improving safety recommendations. And we were able to reach an agreement in principle on that. I've briefed the MEC at their MEC meeting in Fort Lauderdale, and they've approved unanimously to work forward with. We'll get someone from the negotiating committee and ALPA Legal and work with the company on writing final language on a letter of agreement on crosstalk. And we'll put out a lot more education material, educating pilots on what this means for them and how this will benefit safety.
It's suffice to say that our safety programs are always out there on the line because of the engagement of the pilot group in submitting the reports. Mike Borer, our ASAP chair, has probably said it the best. It's a reduction in the safety margin, and it's vital to get that information into these safety programs. Only comes from one place when it comes to our pilot programs is the pilot reporting these things. Yes, it's a little bit of additional time to go into it, and for some, it can be a burden, and there's a right time to go in and do that. But not letting that extra little bit of encumber on time or anything else factor into the submitting or non-submitting of the report. It's the one place that we get, and we would like to continue that robustness of the pilot reporting because it is allowing us to peer into what's going on in a daily operation, because our central air safety, we may fly an awful lot, but we're not flying every leg of every flight every day.
Absolutely, JR. And if I could tie it back to that, the recent events we've had in the industry and the FAA summit is the importance of safety management systems and being proactive and managing risk. The huge component of that, as you said, is the engagement of our pilots in our safety programs, most notably reporting. You can't assume that, like you said, that there's a safety committee and we fly, so we must know what's going on. The truth is we don't know everything. And also, even if we engage the company, we need data to support, you know, the safety assurance and safety risk management processes of the company to make sure that they are looking at these issues and they are mitigating these issues. And so that notably comes from reporting and data. That's filing Aviation Safety Action Program reports or ASAPs. If a gatekeeper from FOQA calls you to talk about something in the FOQA data, engaging, speaking freely, filing fatigue reports. Without that data, we don't know what's going on, and we don't know how to inform the company's safety management system to generate action and address these issues. So absolutely, you, the ALPA pilot, are critical in our safety programs and engagement.
Central Air Safety Chair, Captain Blake Kelly. Blake, thanks again so much for taking a moment out of your day, coming in and giving us an overview of not only just the industry, but some of the hot topics stuff. Here specifically with JetBlue. Always welcome back if something does break, and thanks for joining us here on Ride Report.
Thank you, JR. Can't wait to be back again.
Ride Report, a podcast from the Master Executive Council of JetBlue Alpha for the union pilots of JetBlue.